Welcome to the Natural Running Network. We are brought to you by Mio, makers of the world's first strapless heart rate monitor sports watches, and MedHab, makers of RPM Squared, an innovative system of gait analysis that slips right into your running shoes. My name is Richard Diaz. I am your host. Are you a runner? Do you love to get out and challenge yourself? Running your first marathon, or maybe caught the bug of obstacle racing? Well, sit tight, because this is a show you just don't want to miss.
Good Friday, everyone. I am so pleased to be here, and I have to tell you, this is going to go down in history as probably one of the most interesting interviews we've ever had a chance to do. So whatever you do, do not move away from your audio connection. You need to hear this show. And before we get started, I want to make sure that I give you a few promo codes from a few of our sponsors. If you're interested in getting heart rate, I highly recommend that you look into Mio, Mio Alpha, Mio Fuse, and if you do go to their site to purchase, make sure that you plug in a promo code, which is DIAZ15, which gets you 15% off any Mio product. And MedHab, we're going to talk about this at great length today, but these insoles are absolutely amazing, as you'll learn in a little bit. But we're giving a full $100 discount for anyone that purchases a pair of these insoles online through MedHab. And what you do is go to MedHab RPM Squared, plug in the promo code DiazPromo, and you're going to get $100 off. The least amount of money you'll spend for this highly innovative set of insoles, and you're going to learn about them in a bit. So, with no further ado, I want to introduce you, the audience, to what is arguably the fastest man in the world as a runner, Michael Johnson, four-time gold medalist, eight-time world champion and gold medalist. He set and still holds the record for the 400 meters and had the 200 meters, only man in history to ever achieve this within the same Olympics. And, you know, was recently, the 200-meter record was taken down after 12 years, I might add, by Usain Bolt. But what an amazing, amazing athlete, and I'm going to shut up for just a second and get Michael on and have him say hello to the audience. Michael Johnson, it is an honor to have you on my show, sir.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Michael, I was witness to the amazing performances you threw down in the Atlanta Olympics in 1996, and I'm telling you, I got chicken skin just having a chance to sit here and talk to you.
No, I appreciate that. It's good to be on.
So, Michael, let me just kind of do a few things. Now, you got to forgive me because I'm one of those tongue-in-cheek guys. Whatever goes in my head comes right out of my mouth, so just know that going in. How old are you now, sir?
47.
47 years old. If I took you down to the track today to run a 400, what should you think you could do?
I have no idea exactly what I would do, but what I do know is that it would be significantly slower than what I used to do, and I'm actually not very interested in figuring out how much slower I am than I used to be. That holds absolutely no interest to me to find out how slow I am now versus what I used to be.
I'm with you, man. I'm with you. I just had to throw that out there just out of curiosity, and I didn't know how old you were, so... So I had to ask because I try to put things into context here. So, Michael, I know you grew up in Texas and you had a pretty amazing career in college. I'm looking at some of the numbers you threw down in college, and it doesn't appear to me that there was that huge a difference. And I realize the nature of this sprint that, you know, we're not seeing real big moves between finish times. And just a little bit, fraction of a second is a major difference. But you were fast in college. What the heck, man? I mean, was that it? Just you got up and you were just a great runner from the start?
I think I actually benefited from the fact that if you go back to my high school career, I wasn't one of those kids that came out of high school with just these phenomenal times. The school that I went to in Dallas, my high school, Skyline High School in Dallas, was a magnet school, and our sports weren't very good. The focus was all on academics. You had to apply to get into the school, and I somehow snuck in. So sports just wasn't really a real focus. So my freshman year of high school, I didn't even run track. I'd run track, played football in junior high, and played soccer and everything else when I was in elementary school. But when I got into high school, I was so focused on the academics. My freshman year, I didn't run track, and then I missed it. And so my sophomore year, I came back out for track, but I came out at the end of the season. I didn't get a full season in and beat all of the guys on my team. In the last meet of the year, my coach was like, you know, where has this guy been? And so junior year, I come back out and have a full season. But even then, the sports at my school was, so my high school coach was the defensive coordinator for our football team. And he would literally come out the week before the track season began and said, all right, who's running track? So literally guys were, all right, I'm going to run. Yeah, I'm going to run. And so we haven't done anything. So it's only, you know, by the time we get to, you know, the end of the season, are we actually starting to get in any sort of condition or shape or anything. So I was underdeveloped dramatically. And my senior year, it was the same situation. And so my coach, but even off of that, I was running some of the fastest times in the country. And my coach was, you know, just basically writing and calling every college coach in the country saying, hey, look, I have no clue what I'm doing. And look at what this kid is doing. So imagine what his potential is. And so so I got recruited and went to Baylor. And so my freshman year at Baylor, things just took off because it was the first time that I had ever gotten into a program where I was actually able to train and actually get into shape and get some conditioning work and get an off-season program. And that's why my times just dramatically dropped from the first time I ran a race at Baylor University.
So basically, you just had the gift. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I was always fast. I was fast from the very beginning. I mean, from the very beginning when I was I played all different sports, and I was always the fastest on the soccer team, fastest on the football team. You know, I was always fast. But you know, this was in the 70s, and you know, when I'm in, you know, elementary school in 70s and 80s and whatnot, and you know, and I'm growing up in Dallas, Texas, there's nobody from my neighborhood that's ever gone on to be an Olympic athlete or any of that sort of thing. And my parents are working their tails off trying to just, you know, make sure that we get an education and hopefully get into college somewhere. They're not, you know, nobody's got time. Where I grew up, nobody had time to be dreaming about going to the Olympics. So there was no one saying, oh, man, this kid's got great talent at, you know, 12 years old. Let's put him in a program or let's, you know, kind of take him out and, you know, and start to give him some instruction so that he can reach his full potential. There was none of that sort of thing. So I was just out there having fun. And I think, again, as we started this conversation off, I think that I benefited from all of that. I benefited from the fact that I was able to progress slowly without getting too far ahead of myself. You know, when I was in, you know, sixth grade, I just wanted to be faster than all the other sixth graders. I'm not thinking about the Olympics, you know. And I think that in the end, that was a real benefit.
Wow. Okay. So let's talk about the type of training you did do when you got to Baylor. Was the majority of the type of things that you did, was it spent in the gym doing a lot of strength training?
Well, actually, Richard, it's interesting. So when I first got to Baylor, I guess that I got into an off-season program where we started, you know, the first week of school in the fall in September, we started our off-season training. And so we're doing long runs and things like that. And, you know, not on the track. We're out on hilly courses, almost cross-country-like courses and, you know, that sort of thing. And then we're doing on the track one day a week. And then we start to taper down and get into more of some strength endurance stuff and, you know, kind of November, December before we go into the indoor season. And, yeah, we're in the weight room, but I'm in the weight room not actually doing what I'm supposed to, and we're going to get to that later because it's an important part of the story and of my development as well. I just never liked lifting weights, so I wasn't really as dedicated to my strength training program as I should have been. But those are we were doing a lot of over distance and just general conditioning work for about a month at the very beginning, and then we started getting into a lot of the more strength building and building a base in sort of September, October, November, December, before we went into the indoor season in January. And then, of course, in college, you're running from January to May with the indoor and outdoor season. So that's the sort of work we were doing.
Yeah, it kind of surprises me that they actually had you doing long-distance running when you're focused. I'm assuming that in college your focus was more towards the 200 meters?
Yeah, but it doesn't matter if you're a 200-meter or 100-meter or even if you're a 60-meter sprinter and indoors as a track athlete, you've got to do – think about it, Richard. I'm a sprinter, so when I say distance, that means we're doing like from, 800 repeats and stuff like that.
Right.
So I'm sure a lot of your listeners are going, that's all? That's what you call that distance? But it felt like distance for us.
But it's
over distance for us. We would go out, we're doing we have one day a week where we're out doing, putting in a few miles, and then the other times basically what you're doing is it's not doing distance for just, for a distance sake. It's you're basically building a conditioning base so that then 2 months from, September when it's November and now you're starting to do, 8.642 ladders and back up and that sort of thing. Are you doing, four times, 600 with minimal rest in between and those sorts of intervals that your body's able to actually, sustain that and you're actually in condition to actually be able to do the work and be able to put forth the effort and finish the workout that was going to be coming up as we get later to into the cycle.
So I have an interesting tidbit that came up just the other day. I'm actually consulting for a running shoe manufacturer right now, and I was sitting in the office of a sports performance company here on the West Coast. I don't know if you're familiar with them. Being in the business you're in, you might be, but you ever heard of P3?
I have not.
Dr. Marcus Elliott?
No.
Anyway, so I'm sitting in an office with these guys, and we were discussing this running summit we're going to do, and these guys have a pretty sophisticated facility. I was, we were talking about sprinting and the nature of training because we do a lot of work with football, baseball players, and, they were talking about a lot of these pro teams are actually having some of the baseball players do a lot of long-distance running, and it's sapping their power, So they'd run for 20 minutes at the end of a workout, and they felt that it was really extracting some of the power that was necessary to perform. But anyway, in the course of the conversation, I brought you up, and I mentioned that we were going to have this interview today. And the guy I was sitting with, he used to work for Nike, and he told me that he was really good friends with the guy that actually made your gold shoes.
That's possible.
But your shoes were Nike, right? You were designed by Nike?
Yes, they were.
Yeah. So anyway, apparently the name escapes me, but if the fellow that actually designed the shoe or manufactured the shoe, apparently they had worked together and for whatever it's worth. But gold shoe thing came up, and that that was a result of it all. So you go to the 1996 Olympics. You probably knew going in that you were just going to kill this thing. Did you have any designs on actually – I mean, you set the 200, 300, and 400-meter world records. Did you do the 300 in that time? I know that's not actually a competitive distance in the Olympics, right?
It's not an Olympic distance. It is a distance that so what they recognize as a world record, you'll have that. It's an odd distance. You run it every now and then. I broke it in the year 2000. As I was preparing, I was running a race down in South Africa. So I was preparing for the 2000 games, and I broke it then.
So, but you did you know going into the 96 Olympics that you had a better than 80% shot at setting a world record at these two events?
Well, being the world champion from the year before in both events and having broken the world record, I thought, I'm in pretty good shape. had broken the world record in 200 meters a month before the games at the Olympic trials. But look, you know, it's no different than any other race. You still have to run the race, you know, right. So regardless of how. And there's seven other people that are going to get in that final, and they're not just in there just to be hanging out.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
They're in there to win it too. And so, you know, confidence is a great thing. And if you can take some confidence into an Olympic final, you know, that certainly is a huge help. And so, yeah, having been the world champion in 1995 in both the 200 and 400 meters, so taking that into 96 as well as I said, having broken the world record just a month before in the 200 meters, I was confident that if I go in and execute and do all of the things that I need to do from an execution standpoint, a preparation standpoint, then, yeah, I can probably win it. But you know, there were some other really fast guys running that year, and they had different ideas than I did. But also, you know, and again, you know, the key is you're still going to have the race, and so you have to go in and execute it. And anything can happen in the race. So fortunately, it all worked out in the end.
Yeah. So did you mess those guys up when you showed up with those gold shoes? I mean, did they like, oh my God, what's up with that?
Yeah, I don't know what effect it had on them, but I was fortunate in the fact that it didn't have the wrong effect on me because so the guy that you mentioned that was the shoe designer from Nike that designed those shoes, Toby Hatfield, we worked on that project for about a year, and the whole idea was based on developing a new and innovative shoe that would be the lightest and most stable track spike ever made. And so we worked for about a year on that. And when it came down to the color was decided in less than, I mean, it was a 1 minute process.
Wow.
And I mean, and I bet I never had time to even think, what if I don't win gold? You know, I just never even thought about that. It never entered my mind. So
yeah, I would imagine that.
You know,
you put those on and you got to say, I better bring it now, man.
Exactly. So I was fortunate that it didn't have the wrong effect on me where I show up at the games and walk out into the stadium and realize that, oh, my God, what have I done?
Yeah.
I was always confident. Confident.
Well, again, I remember very vividly watching you set that record or win that gold medal, I should say, or those gold medals, I should say. And you know, and I know, I mean, I got to touch on this because we're going to be talking about gate stuff in a little bit. But I know you probably got a lot of grief for your running style.
It's interesting. People say that, and it's funny, and I make fun of it myself a lot of times. But when you're in front and you're winning, generally don't get much grief.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm a form Nazi. I mean, I watch people run. That's what I do every day, you know, and I work with people's running gait, and I have things that I want to see my runners do. And it isn't, you know, sometimes it's a wrestling match, but I keep leaning back on just physics and nature and gravity. And I look at, you know, as a matter of fact, I look at some of these elite marathon runners from Kenya and Ethiopia. And, you know, for the most part, from the standpoint of the way they run, I mean, they are running machines. They are designed to run long distances. And, you know, everything about them, everything about they came up, where they lived, everything about them put them into that perfect storm to be able to do what they do. But having said that, you know, I see where, you know, like for give you an example, Haile Gebrselassie, when he broke the world record in the marathon, the guy really runs like a duck, you know, and I'm thinking, God, if we just kind of clean that up. But it's difficult to criticize someone when they're in front, like you're saying. It's like, how do you say, well, wait a minute, man, that's not the way to do it. You can't really say that, right? But you know, I look at it, and your upright posture when you were running, it almost looks surreal. It almost doesn't look like it's supposed to happen. And your cadence, you're flying, man. And that upright posture, I just would have thought that somewhere along the way, your coaches would have said, look, Michael, if we just lean into the wind a little bit, we might get a little bit more speed out of this.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, I was fortunate to have a coach that, you know, when I came out of high school, all of the coaches except for one told me that I would have to change my style. And if you asked any of those coaches why, their basis for that was that everyone else runs different. Yeah, but everyone else is behind me. I'm beating those guys. And so when you take the idea that leaning into the wind is going to actually, as a sprinter, is actually going to make you faster, that may not be true. If you take the idea that, you know, everybody else is running one way and one guy's running the other way, so he must be wrong, it's a very simplistic view, and it's often the times what gets coaches in trouble. So I said that every coach but one said that I had to change my style, and the one that didn't say that was Clyde Hart, who ultimately ended up my college coach and my coach for the remainder of my for all of my professional career. And he had a very different perspective. He is, I mean, so just to give you a little background on Clyde Hart, he's also coached Jeremy Warne. He coached me in terms of 400 meters, there's nobody better. He coached me to an Olympic gold medal at 400 meters and four world championships at 400 meters, two Olympic gold medals at 400 meters, and the only person to repeat as 400 meter world Olympic champion. He coached Jeremy Warne to an Olympic gold medal at 400 meters and a silver medal at 400 meters. And he just recently in 2012 coached Sonia Richards to a 400 meter Olympic medal. So he knows 400 meters. And he said, look, the first time I saw you run, you look different from the other guys. But the first thing I did is, and he again, like you said, form Nazi, he is one as well. And so am I. And he looked at it and he said, it's different, but I don't see anything that's inefficient. And then he also said, I see some things that may actually be a little bit more efficient, but I'm not sure. So he doesn't change anything because he realizes that there's nothing that I'm doing, even though it looks different from everyone else, there's nothing that I'm doing that is working against me or that is inefficient in terms of my running style. And that's the only reason you change anyone's running style is because they're doing something. And usually if it looks different, they are doing something inefficient. But you have to ask yourself first if that's the case. So that's what he did. Then he also revealed something, and I heard this. I didn't hear it directly from Clyde. I heard it in the media years later when I was in the middle of my professional career, and he said, hey, one of the things I also saw with Michael when I first saw him run is that he reminded me of another sprinter. And he said, you know, everyone was focused before Michael came along. Carl Lewis was the iconic sprinter. He had that beautiful forward lean, but he said, everybody forgot about a guy named Jesse Owens.
Right.
Arguably the best sprinter ever in the history of sprinting. If you ask my opinion, absolutely the best that there's ever been. And upright running style. And so then to finish this whole thing, Richard, you know, my coach and I always wanted to make sure that we actually were doing everything that we possibly could to ensure that, you know, we're not missing anything. So in 1993, we actually had a study done in conjunction with the U.S. Olympic Committee, and they had this model that they had made and with all of their sports scientists, taking a lot of the great sprinters over the history and putting all of the, you know, stride length and stride frequency and all of those different things into play and to build the perfect model for a sprinter. And they put my style up against it and put me up against that model, and I beat the model. And it turned out that I was a lot more efficient than the model that they had built, because the upright running style was creating a lot more downforce, which you need as a sprinter, not necessarily as a distance runner, but as a sprinter, you need downforce. And I was creating a tremendous amount of downforce because of my running style. So there you have it.
Well, so let's talk about that for a second. Now, I'm kind of a geek. I look at this stuff, and being in the world that I'm in, I know a lot of other geeks that look at this stuff. And a fascinating point of interest that I thought, and I've been using quite a lot, is I got a guy that's a this guy is an astrophysicist. Okay, he's basically a rocket scientist, and it's all about propulsion, lift, and gravity is what they make their bones on. And the guy made a really interesting comment to me. He said, every single animal on this planet requires 7.5 centimeters of lift in order to move their body through space one body length. So, for example, if you're 6 foot, in order for you to travel 6 feet in a particular direction, you require that much lift. Anything beyond that would be considered excess and costly. Now, in a sprint, we're not really so much worried about cost because it's over pretty quickly. In a longer distance, it becomes more paramount. It becomes a bigger consideration. So I guess I understand that if you're getting good propulsion or good force production out of the ground, that's obviously key, especially in an event like you're in. And then obviously enough, if you can create the turnover, you got the leg turnover happening while you're in space, you're just going to, you're just going to travel faster. But again, I guess the what's left out of that equation is whether you're moving forward with that propulsion or whether you're moving up and down. And apparently
we didn't talk about recovery and turnover. So then, if you also look at recovery, trail leg recovery,
right,
with a much more upright style, you're going to recover that trail leg behind you, and it's going to come right behind you and right up to the bottom of your butt every single time, as opposed to that long leading trail leg, which is going to get your air time and give you much more air time, which is exactly what you don't want.
Well, it's interesting.
There's a reason for it all, Richard. There's a reason for it all. It's not just that it just looked different and it was just kind of different and it was kind of funny and just miraculously I happened to be faster than everybody else with a funny different style.
You know what's going to happen after this show is that every sprinter that listens to this is going to change the way they run and try to stand upright.
Now, not necessarily, because I've been retired for 15 years now, and people aren't emulating it, and they're right not to try to emulate it, because it's difficult to change your style. As long as you're not doing anything that is working against you, then you do what you do, and you figure out how you best accomplish what's best for you as an athlete using the physics that you have, as opposed to trying to emulate someone else. But you can take some elements away, but as you would imagine, it would be very difficult to tell an athlete who's 20 years old or even 16 or 17 years old, now all of a sudden I want you to change your body position to run more upright, if that doesn't come naturally to them. Because there are some biomechanical things, there are some physiological things that I have just naturally in terms of the way that my body is structured that allowed me to do that. It wasn't something that – now, we obviously started doing some things in training and implemented some things from a training standpoint to be able to try to enhance that, and even and to make it even better. But it's not something that you can just, just kind of train yourself to do.
Right. So since we got off into this training thing, and I love this, by the way, let's talk a little bit about your performance centers and what spiked that and how's that all going?
It's going fantastic. So I retired in 2000. I started Michael Johns Performance a few years later, and our original when I first started Michael Johnson Performance or NJP, I first started. We were working primarily in football, and working with guys developing speed, and then we started to expand into European soccer, so global football as we call it, and all other sports, baseball as well, and basketball, So we've just grown from there. We're headquartered in Dallas, but we're a global organization. We have training programs for development programs for youth athletes. We have training enrichment, athletic enrichment programs for elite and professional athletes from around the world. We have global operations in Brazil, Azerbaijan, UK, Trinidad, the Caribbean, Asia. So, we've grown quite dramatically over the last 8 years, and our real mission is just we're focused on development of athleticism. We're not sports specific. We work with athletes in every sport. Just to give you a sense of how varied we are, we're the official training partner for the Pro Bowl Riders Association. We work with lots of bull riders on injury rehab as well. We have physical therapy clinics in all of our as a part of all of our operations. And, yeah, so we work with Formula One teams as well. We have a large presence in Europe, working with the athletes there. Soccer teams, obviously in the UK, is a big part of our business with some of the big names, Arsenal and Manchester United. We work with several different Olympic federations, the Brazilian Olympic Federation. We have Paralympic federations as well. And so it's been great. The our real objective and the real impetus for starting this company for me was I was fortunate during my career to get through till the end of my career and pretty healthy, and also having had the opportunity to achieve all of my potential as an athlete. And that was something that the idea was to develop an organization that could help other athletes to do the same thing, regardless of what level they may be at. So we've got, 13 and 14-year-old kids who, by the time that they're 17, 18, and they finish high school, their professional, or their competitive careers are over, but they've reached their full potential, and they're satisfied. And then, of course, then we've got college athletes as well that go on to get college scholarships. And then we've got athletes who have gone on to go into the professional ranks of sports, Olympic level as well. And but our objective is to support them with injury prevention programs, mental skills programs, nutrition, but most importantly, athletic development programs that are going to help them to reach their potential as athletes.
That's awesome. So then, interesting note to me is that I came to, and we're leading into this, but I came to MedHab. I don't know. I think I found them on the internet, just perusing the things that I do. And I got onto these insoles that you can shove into your shoes, and it's going to report to you what is occurring on ground contact and flight while you're moving through space. And the cool thing about it to me was the fact that I could put insoles in a client. Like, I do online coaching where I'm working with people that I'll never meet. They live in other parts of the world. And I'm trying to get some intelligent information and feedback back and forth between us. And I saw these insoles and I thought, you know what, I got to meet these guys. I got to figure this out. And it sounds to me like somewhere along the way, that's pretty much what happened with you and how you ended up becoming partners with MedHab. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. So we're both headquartered in the Dallas Fort Worth area. Our world headquarters is in Dallas. They're over in Fort Worth. And so they approached us and knew that, some of the work that we were doing, similar to some of what you're doing. We work with athletes all around the world, even though we've got operations all around. We work with athletes who sometimes, they'll come over, they'll fly to the U.S. from anywhere around the globe, and we'll do assessments on those athletes. We work with them for a week or two, and then they go back to join their club, if it's a football club or whatever, go back to wherever their home base is. And then we continue to work with those athletes. But we do lots of different assessments, whether the athletes are in front of us or are in the follow-up with our remote coaching. We do lots of assessments. And so the more information we can get on that athlete, the better it's going to make our coaches. And so you're never going to replace coaches. Lots of technology out there now. You're never going to replace good coaching, but our coaches want every tool that they can possibly have at their disposal. And my job as CEO of the company is to provide them with the best tools so we can provide the best support for our athletes. When MedHab approached us, we thought it's innovative. It's very interesting. It's going to provide us some information that we don't normally get. And it's going to be able to confirm some things in our assessments and in our physical therapy and functional movement screens and whatnot that and injury prevention assessments that we think we know. This is going to provide some additional information to us and confirm some of those things. So we started talking with Johnny Ross and the guys over at MedHab about their product, and we started trialing it. Our coaches, my coaches, spent hours working with those guys and understanding the product and how we may be able to implement it into some of the things we do, and that's how the partnership was formed.
So yeah, that, you know, I assume that it was something to that level where you started looking at, and I say this all the time, by the way, and I know we're new to each other, but I tell athletes that I interview that, you know, especially when they're not gathering as much information as they possibly can. This is 2015. We're in the new millennium. I mean, we have all kinds of information that we can access to, you know, lead us to make better decisions about the way we move through space. And, you know, to discount any potential information that gathering is ridiculous. I mean, and so this is just taking it to a completely different level where I'll do video gait analysis on athletes daily. And, you know, their perception of what they're actually doing while they're running, what part of the foot is making contact with the ground, the hang time that's associated with it, the force production that's associated with it, the inequity in the way they're making contact with the ground. All of this information is being able to gather it and show it to them is just very, very powerful stuff. So, you know, just for the sake of the audience that's trying to figure out what we're talking about, these insoles, for the most part, what I've learned is, you know, you charge them up on this charging plate, you shove them into your running shoes, and then you simply begin running. And, you know, through an app that you carry with you, you can upload this information, and it very pointedly shows what the force production is, what contact points are, and it will start to speak towards what I'm going to have you build on is this bilateral equivalence, making sure that both legs are doing essentially the same amount of work as opposed to having compensatory issues with the way you're running. And, you know, I'm a strong believer in getting people off of their heel and overstriding and just being able to do nothing more than that, being able to show someone where, in fact, their contact points are, what their stride frequency looks like, and how much force production they're getting is all powerful, powerful information that, you know, for the most part, most people won't get on their own. So what are the real deal points that you look for when you use the, or when your people use these insoles with their athletes?
Yeah, you know, I think it varies, Richard, from, you know, you just brought up one example in terms of trying to get people off of their heels so that they're not overstriding when you're training them when you're doing your gait analysis and when you're watching them run and trying to make their form more efficient. But for us, working with athletes in all different sports, our coaches, whether they're working with football players on their footwork or whether they're, you know, working with athletes on linear speed and measuring gait analysis, measuring stride length to ensure that there's equivalence on both sides for an efficiency standpoint. And also in our advanced athlete assessment, which is one of our most popular products, we've integrated the RPM square inserts into that process now to assess an athlete from an injury prevention standpoint to see what type of musculoskeletal imbalances there may be with that athlete from the bottom all the way up through the chain. So we're using it, and because you're able to get so much information from a symmetry standpoint, you can use it for whatever any coach may need to find out more information about that athlete or may need to analyze that athlete from the perspective of understanding how they're actually moving. This actually does that for you. And so it's not limited, and I think that's the great thing. It's not limited to just one sort of ideas in terms of, you know, what the use might be from a coaching standpoint. It varies depending on actually what the coach is trying to accomplish with that athlete.
Right. Well, one of the things that I've done, and I came up from triathlon back in the day, and I also do clinical assessments of VO2 and write heart rate prescription for athletes. And that led me to actually doing bike fitting. And I'll put a triathlete, you know, they'll come in to do a dual VO2. I'll test them on a bike, then I'll test them running, trying to find what their threshold looks like. And I found more often than not that their threshold suffered when they were on the bike. And it led me to understand that part of the reason was mechanically they were deficient. They were on the bike improperly. So I actually, you know, sought one of the better fitters out in the world and had him come stay with me until he trained me to learn how to properly fit someone to their bike for time trial, road racing, whatever it might be. And so the hole in the program has always been for me, you know, I'll do some measurements, but they're static measurements. I measure the varus-valgus relationship of the way they're making contact with the pedal, things like this. But being able to show force production through the pedal during the bike fit to analyze whether the change in posture on the bike has made significant improvements in their power production and comfort for that matter, this is a very powerful tool for that. And I don't think too many people out there in the world of cycling or triathlon are even aware of this being available, especially since these things provide power output on the fly. You know, you could basically put your phone on your bike and capture real-time power production through both feet. And you could do it according to what we're doing today. It's like about $500 to get accurate power meter while you're riding. So there's just, you know, I guess the reason I'm talking about this so much and the reason I even brought these guys on as a sponsor with us is they, you know, they're filling a gap in my processes that is very, very helpful for me.
Yeah, and at a very economical price, because I mean my understanding is that power meters are quite expensive. They're one dimensional. You got to attach it to the bike, and it really, that's really what it does for you. So you mentioned triathletes, and so triathletes are running. They're doing their running training. They're also doing their bike training, and so this certainly does fill a gap, as you said, for the triathlete at an economical price, but also a multi-dimensional tool that they're able to use in running as well as on the bike itself. And as I mentioned before, I mean, and it's not you know, it's multi-dimensional in terms of its uses because of all of the different things that it does measure. I mean, from step time to range of motion, stride length, all of those things are measured by the device. So regardless, we see a lot of triathletes with injuries. And this has been extremely helpful for us and athletes coming back from injury to get an understanding of the symmetry issues and if that particular area, that particular side is still causing any problems and if they're back to the previous pre-injury effectiveness that they previously demonstrated.
Yeah, well, I could tell you that just the idea, and this is a notion that most people that are, if they're listening to this, they start scratching their head and starting to realize that up until now, it is almost impossible to get power meter information from running. And, you know, that's kind of been the holy grail for runners is we look at heart rate, we look at distance, we look at all these different metrics, but we've never been able to actually look at power production. And so that not only can you get it off the bike, but you take the insoles out of your cycling shoes, shove them into your running shoes, and just change the parameter in which you're hoping to track data, and you've got both. And you could do a ton of really interesting comparative analysis that way. And so getting back to the distance coaching, or what you refer to as remote coaching, now I have clients right now on the East Coast. I've had them as far away as Australia, where we're having conversations through Skype. They're sending me video clips of the way they're moving. And so I'm getting a two-dimensional view of the way they're moving, but I'm not really getting a chance to see. I mean, I could see what their cost is because they're sending me heart rate. But the thing is they send me the video. I'll do some edits. I'll send the videos back, which is it's good stuff. But if I was able to slip these insoles into their shoes, once they've done a workout, you know, they send the reports back to me, and I get them instantaneously as they will, and I could see whether they're improving or not and make comments about what I think they should be doing next, as well as they could see in fact that this information is it's irrefutable. I mean, I'll have people that want to argue with me about what they're doing or not doing when I say they're doing something, and so this basically it's like fish or cut bait. You're either doing it or you're not doing it, or it's getting better or it's not getting better. So it becomes a really powerful tool in that respect. So for whatever it's worth,
I think, you know, it all about data, Richard. And the more data you can collect and compare, you know, the more powerful you become because you've got that knowledge and you understand where you're tracking, how you're tracking, how you're improving. Again, we talked about, you know, our athletes when they're recovering from injury, you know, the most critical thing for us to understand is how they're tracking, and they're tracking back to their original pre-injury condition. And we work with just as many coaches as we do athletes. Many of the athletes that come in, we're working with those athletes and coaches as well. Just as you mentioned, you know, these the athletes you're working with are able to send the information back to you. With this particular, I mean, with the RPM Square device, you're able to take the app and actually just send the information right over to the coach, or they're able to send it right back to us with just one click. So, you know, technology obviously is changing. A lot of it wasn't around when I was competing, but it's changing the way that that we live our lives, and it's no different within sport. That, you know, technology is an incredible tool for us to be able to leverage. And so for that reason, you know, again, like I said before, my coaches, they've got great knowledge and experience. They're fantastic coaches. You're never going to take away coaching. You know, I mean, it's critical to, it's the most critical part of my business, having great coaches. But as I said before, I've got to give them the tools that they need to be able to do their job as best they can. And so this is certainly a tool that they feel confident in its ability to help them to be better and better serve our athletes.
You know, it's interesting. My producer just made a comment here to me, and it's a good point to bring it up. But a while back, I was contracted by ESPN Sports Science to do some testing for one of their episodes on DeMarcus Beasley. He's from Texas. You probably know him, don't you?
I know of him.
Okay, DeMarcus Beasley. Obviously, he was a four-time World Cup competitor for the U.S. Been on the U.S. team, and they were doing all sorts of assessments on him, you know, just, I guess the show kind of revolves around the fascination of, you know, the human condition, how athletes are able to do what they do. And so, you know, it started out where, you know, I came a little early. I set up my Met cart to do my testing on him. But I was the last part of the segment, so I just sat around the studio, and they've got basically a mock soccer field with a net, and they set him up where they had this ball throwing machine that pitched these soccer balls at him at chest level, and you know the goal was to let the ball bounce off his chest and try to measure the contact time from when the ball came off his chest to the time that he kicked it into to the goal. And then they had him do essentially a run through some barriers and just some cones, basically, to measure his agility and speed. And while they were getting him all harnessed up for all this data collection, the biomechanist that they had there was strapping him up. They had these devices that they put on his ankles with these power packs and this waist belt that he had to wear to carry some fashion of receiver, but I don't know how much hardware he had on, but I sat there giggling to myself, and I thought, you know, if they only knew, all they needed to do is shove these insoles in his shoes, and they could have collected as much information, if not more, without all that cumbersome hardware that they were putting on him. It was just an interesting time, and I actually did speak to the biomechanist after the fact. I said, have you ever heard of these insoles put out by RPM Squared? And she looked at me puzzled. She was not even aware that they existed. And I actually got her card. I promised Johnny I would get it to him, and I never did. My bad. Probably will make that hookup. But anyway, this is like supposed to be the epitome of cutting edge analysis for television. And you know, they were really pretty much in the dark ages too.
Yeah, and I think you know, these things are coming so fast, so quickly. I mean, like I said, I mean, in every other area of our lives, technology is just moving very, very quickly. And the same thing is happening with all of the different, you know, trackers, even whether it's fitness trackers or GPS tracking for a lot of the athletes and sports teams, and then heart rate monitors. And I think that one of the things is, you know, people don't know about this sort of technology because it is quite innovative. I mean, you know, one of the things I think people think of an insole, you know, and they think it's an orthotic, and this is not an orthotic. This is actually a device that's designed to provide feedback to you from, you know, really one of the most critical areas of athleticism, and that is the lower chain and how you're actually moving from an efficiency standpoint. So it's all very new. You know, it's innovative. It's not something that that we know about. You know, everybody knows about heart rate monitors. You know, you talk about VO2. Yeah, we all know about VO2 now. And, you know, you know about heart rate and all of those sorts of things. And this is the first time, you know, that we've had these devices that are now starting to come out that are able to track, you know, from a biomechanical standpoint, collect data, attract people to understanding the data and being able to track that data and being able to compare it.
Yeah. Well, clearly for me, and this is, again, this is my day-to-day job, is I have clients come to me all the time. 99% of them come to me not because their performance interest, but primarily their interest is they want to stop being injured. And as you probably are aware, you know, there's 45 million runners in this country, recreational runners, and a good percentage of them, better than 75% of them, are injured commonly, and it is, you know, it's proven to be directly associated with poor running mechanics or improper training programs. So, you know, being able to take that next step and start showing people how to mitigate some of these injuries and allow them to get back out there and do the thing they do, it's a very powerful aspect of the business. I mean, I have people come to me and I say, look, I can help you run faster. Well, that's novel. They're interested in that, but they're not going to set a world record. They're not going to get paid to do it. They're not going to get, you know, they're not going to be world beaters. They just, their biggest concern is more so that they don't want to hurt. They want to be able to do what they do, live that happy lifestyle, and not be broken down and sidelined because of injuries. And so I think it's really important to be able to provide that type of feedback for people. So it's going to be implemented.
Absolutely.
And it's going to be implemented in most of the processes that I do here. It's just a very powerful tool. And, you know, I get older and I keep learning more and more about what it is we can do for these folk. And this has just been a very powerful tool to stick in my quiver. So,
yeah,
Michael,
absolutely. I agree. It's I mean, from our perspective at MJP, I mean, we're a development partner for MedHap for the RPM2 device. We've tested it. We're providing, our coaches are providing feedback, and we get not only the elite athlete, but we do get the triathletes and endurance weekend warrior athletes that come into our facility for our advanced athlete assessments that provide the information back to them. And to your point, most of them are coming in. They want to be better, yes, but most importantly, they don't want to have to stop and have any sort of pauses in their activity. And that generally happens because of injuries. And so they come into us for injury prevention. Many of them come to us because they've been injured, and they first enter us through our therapy clinic for rehab, and then they find themselves over on our performance side looking for us to help them to prevent injury. And so the RPM Square device is crucial, and we recommend it to those athletes so they can start to understand themselves, because they're not being coached by us on a daily basis, because, like you said, these aren't the athletes that are going to be making money and winning and breaking world records. And so they're not going to be training with us on a daily basis as our elite athletes and do. So these athletes, many times, they're weekend warriors. They're training on their own, but this provides a tremendous amount of data back to them and intelligence back to them about their own performance and how they're actually training, and hopefully sets them up for an ability to correct themselves when they're running in an inefficient manner. And I see people all the time that, you know, you can't have they haven't been coached and they feel like, I'm not at a level where I actually need to invest in coaching. But this certainly provides a situation for them where they're actually able to monitor themselves and understand whether they actually need to go get some help or whether they need to correct something in their technique from the fact that it does tell you whether you're symmetrical or not.
That's absolutely correct. Well, so you're living in California now, right?
I split my time between San Francisco and Dallas, but we're headquartered in Dallas. But I've been in California. I've been in San Francisco, in the Bay Area for the last 15 years. But I spent a lot of time with MJT. Being the CEO of the company is my primary role. I can do that from anywhere. But my other role is managing all of our global services and all of our global customers, as well as our partnerships with we're a development partner for companies like NetApp or RPM Square. We have other relationships like that. Nike, we work with the Nike Sports Research Lab and product development with them as well. So I spend most of my time managing those relationships, so I can do that pretty much anywhere.
Well, Michael, I got to tell you, it's been an honor to have you on my show, and I appreciate that we're basically brethren in the science. We're kind of both with our ear to the ground, trying to find, you know, the most innovative opportunities we can to help our clients and essentially, you know, embed better athleticism around the world, right?
Absolutely, that's what everybody's looking for, and that's what they look to us for. And it's great to have other people out there passionate about it as well.
Well, maybe one day we'll meet, because I'm in California. We're not that far away. And you know, maybe there's a chance I'll get down to your performance facility. I know Johnny Ross would love to see me come back down to his place. And, you know, we shared a few steaks the other night, and he's very passionate about what he's doing. And you know, I love that. So maybe one time I'll get a chance to meet you, and I'm certainly looking forward for the chance.
Absolutely. Well, welcome. You're welcome anytime.
All right. Listen, you have an amazing weekend, my friend, and I hope to, as I suggest, hope to one day get a chance to meet you in person.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Oh, no worries. And so just to recap for the people that are still listening to the show, I offered up a promo code at the beginning of this show to get yourself a pair of these RPM Squared insoles. If you have any questions about that, just reach out to me personally, diazhp@verizon.net. And the promo code, again, Diaz Promo, D-I-A-Z Promo. You guys have an amazing weekend. Well, friends, it's time to bring another show to a close. Be sure and tune in to us next week. We've got a lot of great content in store for you. I want you to tell your friends to check us out. You can always find us on Facebook. Simply go search the Natural Running Network. Drop us a message. I'd love to learn more about you and the things you do. And until then, you have an amazing day.